celebration, innovation and insight at MADE, the Entrepreneur Festival. Join us at MADE Festival to be educated and inspired by a jam-packed day of business success. Hear from JB Gill, farmer, entrepreneur and former member of boy band JLS, Annabelle Carmel, cookery author and entrepreneur, Joe McEwen, head of digital at Innocent Drinks and many more. This year we blend inspirational success stories with business skills training, customer service, sales, marketing and social media, all designed to help you win more customers and increase profit. MADE, the Entrepreneur Festival, 22nd of October, Sheffield City Hall. Visit madefestival.com for more information.
Sheffield Live. Made in Sheffield. Made by you.
The English Beat starring Dave Winkling are coming to O2 Academy Sheffield on Thursday, 17th September. Expect to hear all the Beat's hits, plus tracks from their brand new album, Here We Go Love, as well as backing from Smiling Ivy, The Orphans, Trojan Explosion and DJs. Get your tickets now from o2academysheffield.co.uk.
Begbies Trainer is an independent business rescue and recovery specialist. If your business has financial challenges requiring professional insight and solutions, Begbies Trainer can help. We provide advice designed to help people and companies deal successfully with debt and financial problems. And wherever possible, we will find the best solution that allows for active steps towards financial recovery. Begbies Trainer is an independent business rescue and recovery specialist. We're committed to providing a rapid and responsive service based on in-depth experience, professionalism and independent specialist expertise. Contact our Sheffield office on 0114 285 9500 or visit begbies-trainergroup.com.
Sheffield Live. Made in Sheffield. Made by you.
We're open for business live.
Good morning. It's just after 9 o'clock on Friday, the 11th of September, 2015. My name's Jamie Veitch. I'm your presenter for the next hour for Sheffield Live's business and social enterprise programme, Business Live. We're broadcasting on 93.2 FM and through our internet live stream, and this show will also be available as a podcast later from the Sheffield Live website. In today's programme, we'll be talking with speaker, author and climber Andy Kirkpatrick. Well known in the climbing community for his accomplishments all over the world, Andy makes a living as an author and speaker, and today shares his advice and experience about speaking in public, writing, creating an audience and working with businesses. Before we turn to our interview with Andy, some business and social enterprise news. UK businesses are missing out on £84 billion a year because of poor quality people management, according to a study by Investors in People. Their new report, People Management Benchmark, Impact on Investing in People, found that adopting sustainable, good quality practices would have the biggest positive impact for an organisation's bottom line. They say that, for example, ensuring managers always have the opportunity to develop and update their own people management skills and give them access to the latest information and techniques will make a massive difference. The study was co-authored by economic research consultancy TBR, and it was based on a survey with 8,750 businesses, as well as data from the Office for National Statistics. And of course, you can find that, the People Management Benchmark, Impact on Investing in People report online. Sheffield Business School has been shortlisted for Business School of the Year in one of the most prestigious awards for the university sector. It's a second year running that the school, which is based at Sheffield Hallam University, has been shortlisted for the prize at the Times Higher Education Awards. Last year, it lost out to Salford Business School. The Times Higher Education Awards celebrate the achievements of staff and of students in universities and colleges. They're in their 11th year now. And Sheffield Business School, which has around 8,000 students studying a range of business subjects, is active in one of in more than 30 international markets, and it's one of Britain's, well, it is Britain's largest modern business school. The winner of the award is going to be announced on Thursday, the 26th of November, at a ceremony in London. In case you've missed it, the government at the end of August announced a new target for the amount of public sector contracts given to small and medium-sized businesses. Matt Hancock, Cabinet Office Minister, pledged that by 2020, a third of all procurement deals will go to SMEs, small and medium-sized enterprises, which equates, he says, to an extra £3 billion per year, directly or through the supply chain. Ministers are claiming that central government spent £11 billion with SMEs in 2013-14, 26% of the total spend. And lobbying and campaigning groups such as Enterprise Nation have been campaigning for more contracts to be given to small companies. They say that reducing the dominance held by big business when it comes to government procurement has long been an issue. Sheffield City planners have given plans for Sheffield's second UTC, University Teaching College, the go-ahead, approving the planning application last Friday, September the 4th. UTC Sheffield 2 will prepare students for employment in human sciences and computing, two key growth sectors in the Sheffield City region. Sheffield's second UTC is being led by the Sheffield College, with Sheffield Hallam University and Sheffield Chamber of Commerce and Industry as co-sponsors. The facility, a £10 million facility, is going to be started next month by BAM, BAM Construction. It's been designed by Bon Brian Architects. It's going to open in September 2016 at the Olympic Legacy Park. Employers who will come from the computing, sports, science, healthcare technology, exercise, medicine and well-being sectors are going to be central to the curriculum design and the curriculum delivery. They're going to support students on academic and technical learning as well as career-related skills. And the total number of student places, which is 600, is going to be part of a phased recruitment starting from 2016. And don't forget, following the success of last year's Social Saturday, this year's event, which is organised by Social Enterprise UK, is going to take place on the 10th of October. Social Enterprise UK say they anticipate that Social Saturday 2015 will be a true testament to the strength and the influence of the social enterprise movement. Its aim is to raise awareness of how easy it is to support businesses that trade quality services, quality items, and invest their profits into projects supporting local community, international development, the environment, charities, and other progressive schemes. You can find out more about Social Saturday at socialsaturday.org.uk. Now, as ever, I'd always welcome your views on the business and social enterprise news and what's going on. You can get in touch with this programme and with Sheffield Live by email, jamie@sheffieldlive.org, text 07904 272 200, find Sheffield Live at Sheffield Live on Twitter, find me at Jamie Veitch on Twitter too. Whether you're starting, whether you're running a business or a social enterprise, whether you're self-employed or if you're an employer, we're keen to hear from you. So let's turn now to today's guest, Andy Kirkpatrick. As we've said, author, climber, speaker, and is well known in the climbing community. He's won two awards for mountain literature. He makes his living as a speaker and as an author and works in climbing. And I caught up with Andy last week to, first of all, get some tips for any business or social enterprise people who need to go and speak as part of what they do, but also to unpick how Andy goes about making his living. I'm going to turn to the interview with Andy now.
We're open for business life.
Have you ever had to give a speech or presentation as part of your job? Plenty of us do, and lots of us love doing so, but for many otherwise highly confident and accomplished people in business, in social enterprise or running organisations, the thought of standing up in front of others is enough to break them into a cold sweat. Whether that sounds like you or not, who better to ask for advice about speaking in public than someone who makes part of their living doing it? I'm joined in the studio now by storyteller, comedian, speaker, author and climber, who's been described as being the Ranulph Fiennes of British climbing by the Today programme, Andy Kirkpatrick. Andy, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining me today. Thanks for coming back to Sheffield Live. You were last in a couple of years ago and we haven't put you off. You've climbed in some of the most inhospitable places on Earth, from Greenland to Alaska, Patagonia to Antarctica, and accomplished extraordinary feats on alpine faces and the soaring granite walls of El Capitan in Yosemite in Patagonia. But not only that, you're known for your authorship, your writing, and your speaking. And that's what we're going to talk about today, making your living and how you make your living and tips for people. But before we do that, you just returned from a climbing trip. Where, what, and why?
I could just come back from America. So I was in. I've kind of been in America for like 3 months.
Yeah.
So I had to come back for some work. So it was kind of weird, really. Like, I was out there climbing, like soloing. So I was on this big wall, like a sort of 1,000 meter high piece of rock for 14 days. So that was, it was kind of like, I'm 44. I had my 44th birthday when I was on the wall, and it was incredibly grueling. And part of me was thinking, like, Christ, like, I never thought I'd still be doing this when I was like 44. So, then I went back. I actually took my kids back with me because it was the summer holidays.
Yeah.
So we had like a more of a normal, not I'm going to die type of holiday.
Yeah.
But when you got like teenage kids, you often wish you could die.
Yeah, I think that equates to lots of people, isn't it? But of course, Ella, your daughter, has featured in a BBC documentary about climbing El Capitan with you as well. So,
yeah.
So accomplished it herself, but this time she wasn't hauling herself for several thousand pull-ups.
No,
equivalent.
Well, it was funny because actually, my son who's 13, like, I had to kind of admit finally that he doesn't like climbing, he doesn't like heights. So we, he just kind of finds it kind of tough, all that kind of stuff. So I've always kind of pushed him a little bit too much, maybe. So this time I was like, okay, we won't do anything like that. We'll just do like normal things, like go swimming or whatever. So yeah, it was a bit sad, really. So maybe when he gets older, he'll kind of get into it, but
yeah,
hopefully not too much into it.
Well, he might find his own thing and drag you into other interests,
yeah,
as well. Who
yeah.
knows? So it sounds like a good trip, though, where you were first doing the things that you're very well known for doing in terms of solo climbing,
yeah,
and then family holiday in terms of kids enjoying themselves, you enjoying yourself.
Yeah, like it was. I was doing like some work because I do like product development.
Yeah.
But it felt weird to be going away. But even then, we went away, and there's always some kind of epic, like where we were, they got plague, so we had to leave. So
good grief.
So this plague was going around, like proper plague. All the animals had got it. So, and we were just trying to hang on, and the kids were like, Dad, I think I've got plague, you know, like kids are. And then eventually they came and said, oh, you've got to leave, we got to evacuate the whole campsite because of plague, so we had to go somewhere else. So
these epics, do they follow you around? Do you seek them out? How do you find them?
then we went down to the desert, and we, like, slept in the desert. Like just out in the desert, and it was funny because the kids were really like terrified about sleeping in the desert, and like in the middle of the night I heard these kind of how, and I was like, oh, blooming kids, like messing around, and I was like, oh no, they're real, coyotes
in the desert.
There's lots of, so that was kind of cool. I guess it's like giving your kids different
experiences and experiences they'll remember forever.
Yeah. So we went to Disneyland, like a classic thing.
Yeah.
We went to California, which was absolutely amazing. Like, I've got, like, if you take off your cynical head of being British, it was absolutely amazing.
Right.
And I don't know if Banks has ever been, I guarantee he would probably enjoy going.
Would he really? Yeah.
I don't know. Like, we always see the dark in everything.
Yeah.
You know, like, but you know, everything's like, I guess we're here to talk about business. Like, everyone is trying to make a living, and some people do it much better than other people, and Disney are probably one of them.
Disney are good, I suppose, at giving people memorable experiences. And
But if you look at the craft of what they do,
right,
the craft of running a theme park, or the craft of doing like Fantasia or Snow White and all those kind of things, they're as important pieces of artwork as anything Banksy will ever do. Like, I know it's like very controversial to say that, but the level of skill and also doing something that really goes beyond what's necessary to make money, you know, to make a living animating cartoons is not an easy thing. There are much easier, you could make like pornography, or you could do something else, but you know that. You know, some people are driven to produce amazing. So, and like a theme park is one of those things. You could make something, you know, like half as good, and you would still make a load of money.
But so they're doing the very best. I suppose what they're doing then is embedding storytelling and appealing to emotions and so on within it. Is
like,
that
it's like an integrated thing. It's a very kind of modern view of you making films and you've got a theme park and you're selling TV and merchandise and everything else. You know, like it predates like, you know, George Lucas and all that kind of stuff and Star Wars. But that's kind of the modern way of doing it. You know, like I climb mountains, but at the same time, I write a blog, and the blog is quite well. It's quite, you know, like a lot of people read it, and I said to somebody, oh, I don't get paid to write that blog, and he was like, well, you do get paid, like everyone, you know, you do get paid, and I was like, no, I was like, oh, well, it's kind of true. They don't actually get directly payment for it. Then it fits into me as a speaker, then me.
Yeah.
As you know, like writing and everything else.
It builds, I suppose, to put it in what some people are currently describing it. It builds your platform in terms of your audience.
All these channels and things, and you know, like if I was just like a typewriter repairman, you know, that's all I did, then I won't have much work. So it's that kind of, you know, when one thing kind of slows, like if you're touring, like I'm kind of a similar model as a comedian. So comedians often tour. Like once every like 2 years, and then if you get really successful, you'll tour in Australia or somewhere else, like in a different place, like in that year when you're not touring the UK. So I have a similar kind of model as a comedian, because a comedian, they make the most money in theatre, because there's only one person. So Peter Kay could just turn up,
right?
You know, like in Wembley, you know, he could have like tens of thousands of people. And he makes like 70% of the dough. Where if you're doing like Grease the musical, you know, in Doncaster, you know, that you've got like, you know, you've got 500 people.
You've got a massive cast and crew.
Yeah, divvying it out between everybody.
Yeah.
So if you have that kind of lifestyle, it's like boom and bust. You could make a lot of money. Like I used to, you know, for nearly all my life, I worked in the climbing shops. So I was making like probably less than minimum wage. I was making like £100. You know, at the time it seemed okay, but I was making like. Looking back on it, I was making like £100 a week. You know, probably the most I ever made was like £13,000 a year, which seemed like a lot of money at the time, because I wasn't really, you know,
Living with minimal costs, I suppose.
I'd been like unemployed, so I'd been on the dole for a long time when I was a kid, when I was like a teenager. So I knew, you know, I knew what it was like to live on 27 quid a week. So now all of a sudden you're on 100 quid a week, and like, hey, I'm so rich.
Yeah.
And life's really simple. So you're able to recognise when you have a lot of money, relatively, and when you have a lot less money. It's interesting, because I was talking in Hungary, and in Hungary, they're really into like, so how much money do you make? What's your income? Blah, blah, blah. They're really into directly asking you about money, where in Britain
we don't do that.
Don't say like how much money you earn or something. So I often talk to people who are really good at the sport, and they want to know about how you make money out of sport, how you become sponsored, how you raise your profile and everything else. And I say the most important thing when you're negotiating with somebody, and no one cares how good you are. Like if you're negotiating with someone that sells milk, you know, they don't care what you've climbed or how good you are on a bike or whatever. You just got to tell them, this is what I'm going to do, and this is how much I'm going to cost. This is how much it costs, and then they go, yeah, but that's too expensive. Or yeah, but often in Britain we don't negotiate. We just say like, oh yeah, well I'd like to be sponsored, and you know I could do this and I could do that, and they're like, well how much is it going to cost? Oh, I don't really know. And you know the business is thinking, you know, £40,000 a year, and they're thinking like £40 a month or something.
So there's a massive disconnect between what the athlete who wants to be sponsored is thinking and what the business is thinking. So there's loads to unpack there. There's some really interesting stuff which you've just touched on. So let's talk first then about your work as a speaker, and as you've alluded, you're speaking all over the world. You've got a forthcoming tour as well, all over Britain. You'll be in Sheffield speaking in February next year, I think, but lots of places between now and then in the UK. But you speak worldwide, and that's a big part of your income too, as well as writing as an author. You've had a couple of books that have actually won Mountain Literature Prizes, Psychovertical and Cold Wars, and you've started, in effect, your own publishing business as well, publishing your own shorter books, technical books as well, for climbers and about climbing. So a real mixture there, as well as what you've talked about earlier in terms of product testing for businesses. So first of all, in terms of what seems to be a portfolio income or business or career, if you like, this has all come clearly from the passion for climbing and from being an accomplished climber. But as you've said, if you're trying to strike a deal with someone to sponsor you, whether you climb E8 or E9 or E10, and some of the listeners will know what that means and some won't, starts becoming less important to some of the mainstream sponsors. It's what you can do for that business, I suppose. Is that right?
I think even like a core brand, they're not that interested in how good you are at climbing. It's how good you are selling stuff.
Yeah.
You know, how are you going to help them sell what they want to sell and keep them in business? So it's very rare that, you know, someone like a brand that deals with like triathletes or something, you know, they'll find someone who's like this amazing triathlete, but no one's ever heard of them, and the triathlete's not interested in promoting themselves and they're doing their own thing. They'd rather put money into somebody who's like full of themselves and has a YouTube channel and is tweeting all the time. So a lot of people I meet who are like incredibly talented climbers, but they're too modest. They're too, you know, like, oh yeah, well I don't get free stuff and blah, blah, blah. And it's like, well, who are you? You know, like, you know, you need to have a presence. You need to write and, social media, all that kind of rubbish. And some people just aren't good at it, and they don't get the just rewards.
Yeah.
But then you shouldn't really be doing it for just rewards. They should just be doing it just because you do it, really.
Well, yeah, indeed. But if you're, I suppose, going out and saying, I want to be sponsored, I deserve to be sponsored, then you probably need to think about the fact that what does the business want out of it as well.
Yeah.
So tell me then about...
Often it's less than minimum wage.
Yeah.
Way less. Like people... Who I know are the best climbers in the world. They're like in the UK. Like if they were in any other country, they'd probably be quite successful. They'd have big houses and stuff. But you know, they're on less than someone working at McDonald's. You know, and they're risking their lives and they're doing incredibly dangerous, tough stuff. But they're probably earning like £4,000 a year.
Yeah. Whereas they actually might have done much better to get a job that is flexible and allows them to climb. But your work though, in terms of as a speaker, you talked about how if you're the equivalent of a comedian, so you can go and you can pack out a venue and less people to pay than Greece. So that can be. That could be feast, perhaps, for you one week, but it could be famine the next. But you're touring all over the UK and you tour and speak all over the world. And you've talked in a recent blog about tips for people who have to speak and your own approach as well, which is very much storytelling based. So what is it about your talks that so appeals to people?
I don't know. Like, someone said that how you have a lot of little tiny stories that all draw you back to the main story, so you have lots of, like, it's not really rehearsed, like the slides are in an order, but often you'll start going off onto some tangent about something else that's popping to your head, but I really enjoy doing it. Like, I recently started having some therapy about something, and I realized I was paying the woman to me to talk to her. And she just seemed to be having a good, enjoying me talking to her. And I was sort of like, this is not right. Like, she should be paying me. But it is fundamentally, you have to enjoy doing it. Like, I have worked with other speakers in the past, and you had to pay them to do it, and you could tell because they didn't really enjoy it. They just wanted to get off the stage, and they had no understanding of craft or like how you had to keep working at it all the time and try to make it better and try to make your images better and just don't give people what they expect.
Yeah, that's an interesting point.
Boring, you know, because people have very low expectations about someone standing up, really. You know, unless you go and see, you know, some amazing, you know, Fassbender playing Hamlet or something. You know, you're, you know, you're, it's just a climbing person. or like a running person or a cyclist or something giving a talk about what they do. So it can be really boring. I've been to ones where you've got, like, you know, amazing rugby player, but they're terrible speakers. You know, they can hardly put like two words together. But people love it.
People love it because they're there. Person. I suppose it's a real person and they are there to hear about their accomplishments.
Yeah,
as well.
And they're like heroes, you know. Right, like if you're a big Bob Dylan fan, you know, Bob Dylan could tell you about like how to make an omelette, and you know, you'd like go and see it because it's like Bob Dylan. So I guess it's. I think in my blog I said how, you know, like good music, it gives you the note you expect. So that's why you like, you know, that's why music's enjoy it. So like really great music is where you get a better note than you expect.
Yeah.
You know, somebody that's just like, oh my God, that's, didn't know that it was going to go there. And then, so it's kind of playing with you, like music. So I think it's the same when you're talking, that you have all these tangents. Like I used to start with this, it was me as a picture of a child and I was naked. And that was the first slide. And I was like 6 months old. I'm naked. I'm like climbing up a ladder. I'm doing something. And I used to say, oh, if there's any paedophiles in the audience, you've got your money back already. And so immediately, right from the start, people were like, oh, that's not what I was expecting.
No,
it's kind of funny, inappropriately, but it's also not what I was expecting. So right from the beginning, people got they're on the back foot. Like, where are we going with this? This guy's not Chris Bonington. So it's taking people on a bit of a journey. And it isn't all about being funny. Like there's lots of stuff in there which is actually quite serious. And
yeah,
you know, I've done slideshow, done like talks where at the end, I don't know what to call them, but anyway, I've done shows and people have been like really upset at the end. Like it made them cry, and then other people thought it was hilarious. And it's the same with writing. It depends where you are when you read it or when you hear it. Like a book. People can say that's the funniest book I've ever read. Other ones would be like, you know, it's like really changed your life in a different kind of way.
And
like,
these can be the same response. These can be different responses to the same piece of writing.
I know that it's just a load of stories in a book.
Yeah.
But if that person, that moment, is struggling with like being a parent or being responsibility of being an adult and not being able to do what they want to do, and they read my book, then it's like because you know it's like something. It means more to them because it brings something to it. Or somebody else is just like. Totally happy and, you know, I just want to read a climbing book, then I find it really funny or, you know, so it's quite interesting. And the same with when you're speaking, you're only you know, they meet you halfway. You know, they often say you only have half a good idea. Well, you only have half a good talk and
bring the other half if you engage them and you're taking them on that journey.
Yeah. And you have to capture them really. So like someone said I was very good at, what do you call it when you sort of charm people, apparently? So
charisma.
I don't know if it's charisma, but I'm from Hull. I have charisma in Hull. And I don't think Yorkshire people have charisma, are they? So, but you are like charming people on the stage.
Do you mean front then, I suppose? I don't know.
No, like it's a difference. It's a very fine line between, you know, like, hi everybody, I'm Andy, I'm on the stage, I'm really important. And then the people, oh, go on. And then kind of like, oh, I'm rubbish, mate. Yeah, oh, that's good. And then everyone would laugh and blah, blah, blah. So it's like, it's a weird kind of, you never really know where the line is of being a tall and being a, you know, whatever, being rubbish.
Like but stuff. It's kind of a balance, I suppose. And then some things you do might polarise people. Some people absolutely love it and some people might think.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Like, I'm better now, but I used to speak way too fast. And then Ed Burns, a comedian, came. We did something together, and he came to see me speak. And he said, "Oh, you don't give people time to laugh. Like you're just talking nonstop."
Yeah. Yeah.
And I was like, "Well, it's not meant. I'm not meant to be a comedian. Like, you know, people. You know, I don't have gags.
No, you don't style yourself as that. But then you're finding that people are finding it funny.
Yeah. Like people say, like it's uncomfortable because they're laughing so much. They can't. It keeps being funny. So you kind of need a gap for people to have a laugh, and then like, so it's kind of unexpected. Like it's not meant to be funny, but it just happens to be funny sometimes.
And so that advice from people like Ed Burns, but also from clearly thinking and refining and rethinking and watching your own material as well, has made you refine your speeches and your delivery and your talks and work and so on. And you've talked recently about. Re-watching one of your old shows, one of your old shows on YouTube, and how you found yourself being hypercritical of yourself.
Yeah, yeah, like it just, I know you're just like, oh God, you just look like, you look so, you just look, you kind of look really amateurish, because I'm just like standing there and I'm just kind of just waffling on. But it does actually make me laugh. I always remember I was once on a trip with somebody and was in these bunk beds, and he said, oh, have you got anything to listen to? And I said, oh, I've got this talk on my phone that someone recorded, and you can listen to it if you want. And he put these earphones in, and he started. I couldn't hear what he was listening to, but he started laughing, and the bunk bed started like really shaking. And it started me like really laughing, just wondering what he was laughing at. and when I watched the show, it reminds me of that, because for some bits I just start laughing. I'm thinking this is like weird. I'm actually laughing. I'm actually. I don't know what I'm gonna. I don't remember what I said. And sometimes just go into some weird tangents where I'm like, there's a bit where I'm start saying, oh, do you know that woman? You know that really beautiful woman? And everyone's like, and I'm like saying to someone in the audience, you know who I'm talking about? And I mean, that's even a cooking woman, Nigella Lawson.
Right. Yes.
And I'm thinking like, what was I thinking? Like, who's gonna know I'm talking about? But in my head at the time, I completely thought everyone knew what I was talking about. So I find it's kind of weird to look at yourself and think, like, maybe now I wouldn't just say that. I would have kind of worked out. I'd have like a little post-it note saying Nigella Lawson or something.
Yeah. Well, I was struck by what you wrote in the blog about being hypercritical, but also about how, whilst it was funny in spite of the fact that you perhaps hadn't learned everything that you have now about stagecraft and about the craft of storytelling.
Yeah.
and so on. Whilst obviously it was a great show, and that's When Hell Freezes Over, which you can find on YouTube. It was a couple of iterations back in terms of what you're doing.
I think it was the second proper tour I did in theatres.
Yeah.
And then I've done like two more since, and I'm just going to do like another one. So it's you want it to be like, my benchmark was always, a lot of people have never seen it, but Swimming to Cambodia.
Yeah.
Which was I can't remember his name now, but it was a guy just talking about being an extra on The Killing Fields.
That's right. Yes.
I can't remember his name now, but he's dead now. He committed suicide. Anyway, so but I remember seeing it on Channel 4 in the 80s. And it's just him on the stage, sort of talking about all his anecdotes. And
it was Spalding Gray.
Spalding Gray,
that's
yeah.
Right. Yeah. And, it's something that perhaps people of my generation and your generation, as you said, you're 44, recent birthday, yeah. I'm 43, I can remember that.
Yeah.
But it's well worth digging that out.
Like in those days, in the 80s and the 90s, you know, you had no YouTube or anything.
No.
So if something was like when... you know, you get what's his name? Like really good comedian. Anyway, but you get things that would appear on telly, and everyone would be like talking about it because it was such a big event. Oh, did you see that on Saturday night? Because it was really unexpected. When now there's unexpected things everywhere.
Yeah.
You know, on YouTube and everything else, and you know, Facebook's some amazing thing. But then those days they were like really rare. They were like, you know, bits of diamonds, weren't they?
Yeah, because options were more limited. And when you had the, I suppose, serendipitous joy of discovering something accidental and unexpected.
Late night on Channel 4 or something.
Yeah.
Yeah, and if you saw like a good film that was unexpected, like you'd watch like Brian, is it not Thingy Cox? He used to have those Movie Drome or something.
That's right, Cox, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Or Alex Cox,
yeah. Yeah. And then you have to wait maybe another like 5 or 6 years for it to ever to be on again. You know, it was quite good. I guess it was cool, really. It was rationed, wasn't it?
Indeed. And now we've gone from that sort of rationing to a glut of
But maybe stuff. Maybe like live performance on a stage is almost like going back to that. Like I guess someone can film it, but it's not like being there, like being at a really good music gig or something. So you have that intimacy of there's someone who's really living, or it's a bit like, you know, I guess it's like climbing, you're living or dying by your wits, you know, like you could completely lose it on the stage. Like I've only in my whole life of talking, I must have done thousands of talks now. And I did a talk in Italy this year, and it was translated. And I don't know what happened, but it just didn't work, and there was something which just didn't work, and it was because like talking is like singing, you need like a rhythm and blah blah blah. If it's not working out with a translation, it's kind of like stops and starts, And things which are really funny or work really well don't work so well when somebody else is translating.
No, because the rhythm is completely gone.
Yeah, like some people can speak English can hear a little laugh, and then when it's translated, it's completely flat and dead.
Yeah.
And you know, like I've talked in loads of countries where I translate, but on that one night, it was terrible. But I suddenly started losing my confidence. I'm thinking, oh God, what am I doing? Like, I just wanted to not run away.
Yeah.
So maybe it's good to have those. Like, you should never be too confident in whatever. Like, whether you, like I said, something about writing. You know, the moment you think you're a good writer, that's a really dangerous moment, because that's when you start making, you know, you start believing your own myth. Really, that you can do it. So.
Yes, and you know, if you think you're the next Martin Amis or whatever,
you always need a Martin Amis says it's the. You know, the battle against dead words or something,
yeah.
Writing, you know, and full of, it's like a battle against cliche. So I always feel like I've got Martin Amis like over my shoulder. And even I was writing something the other day, and it said something about this golden slab of granite, like it was about swimming across a lake in America where it was like super, super cold, thought I was going to die. And on the other side, there was this like slab of rock, and I was aiming for the slab of rock. And I realised I put like this golden slab. I was like, "What? I don't need to put gold. You know, get rid of that gold." But and then, but you're always like being really hypercritical about everything you're writing. Like, oh, that's just useless. That word, get rid of that. And so it's pairing
down and getting rid of the superfluous. Yeah. I suppose.
Like I always say, you don't realise it, but you just become like that, and you're the way you're thinking. Like the thing I always say to people is when you write. You know, the cold white snow fell from the sky.
Yeah.
It's like, well, we know it's cold, we know it's white, we know it falls from the sky. Just say it was snowing.
Yeah.
And that's enough. So it takes a lot of effort to make it so simple.
Yeah.
So,
and that goes back, as you say, to not believing in your own myth. I suppose.
But even Ella, my daughter, is writing an essay about Grand Budapest Hotel for school. And she went, I love this film. And I was like, oh, that's too strong a word, you know, to say you love this film. You should write something else. And I realised, you know, she's only 16. I'm like being really critical about the use of language. And, you know, it's quite, it's, you know, you just turn into, one day you just become this person. And you can like, oh, no, that's true. Oh, that's terrible. That is.
So you become an editor as well. You,
I can't spell that. That's no problem.
Well, let's talk about writing. You listen to Business Live on Sheffield Live with me, Jamie Veitch, and I'm joined by Andy Kirkpatrick, who's an acclaimed climber but makes his living as an author, as a speaker, as a professional climber, as a product tester. And he's been described by the Today programme as the Ranulph Fiennes of British climbing. I don't know what they mean by that. What do they mean by that?
I guess he's always known for doing like gnarly things, isn't he? So I guess I must be a gnarly. Yeah. I've got photographs where I look gnarly. So
It's probably a blessing, I'm sure. So Andy, you talked about your living, making a living as a speaker, and we've talked about writing, the process of writing, and editing and being critical of your own work, and keeping on doing that. And you've had two books which have been highly acclaimed critically. Won a Mountain Literature Prize called the Boardman Tasker Prize, a book called Psychovertical and a book called Cold Wars. And they're autobiographical. They talk about your own upbringing, your own journey towards becoming an author and a writer, and the steps that you had to go through as well as your adventures and the many examples of near-death experiences as well. And now you're publishing some hugely popular technical books, e-books, which you sell yourself. So in effect, you set up your own publishing company.
Yeah.
Now, along the way, you must have learnt an awful lot about the process of self-publishing, building your audience, delivering what they want. What would you do differently what are you doing differently from what you were doing when you started that self-publishing?
I guess you have to really not ignore the trends in technology. So you have to be in there at the beginning with Twitter, and you have to be in the, you know, with all these, you know, YouTube channels and all this kind of stuff. Like, you have to really, it's very good to watch somebody else who's really good at that kind of stuff and see what they're doing. You know, if someone starts doing, you know, live. Whatever, you know, you just got to keep an eye on what it is and don't get left behind. So, like, my kids have got like, they had like email, they had like their website domains for their name, you know, about like 10 years ago, because I thought that when they're older, that kind of thing might be important for them.
Yeah.
So it's that kind of, it's keeping up with it. And also, so I found that as I was needing something, a way of selling things, I knew about Kindle when Kindle started coming out, so I was able to start selling books on Kindle, right. Writing books and selling on Kindle. And but also like taught myself how to do websites and things, so HTML and coding. So that meant that coding is similar to write books for a Kindle. And then the technology is moving on, so then you can sell books on Apple. And the system of selling books on Apple is much easier to do. You don't have to like write any code. You just kind of bang things on the thing and it works. Everything's kind of connected. Like you're saying about Walt Disney, you know, like you learn to use Photoshop, and then you learn to use Adobe Illustrator, so you can illustrate things, and then later on that helps you in forms like doing editing, because you've got a basic understanding of the systems and things. So things just come along. So like Kickstarter, so you have this idea for a book, but it's the problem with the book, it's going to cost you several thousand. You know, it could cost you a lot of money to produce a book, and then you have to wait for people to buy it.
Yeah.
So, like, if you're kind of boom, like a boom and bust kind of person, like I don't have, you know, like I had this anecdote about, you know, literally having not enough money to go on the train to Manchester. You know, and there you are, this kind of successful person, and I literally came back from Antarctica with not enough money to even get a train ticket. Yeah. Oh. And then 6 months down the line, you've got loads of money in the bank. So. But then if you spend like half of it on a book, then you could be waiting, no one might buy it.
You don't know how long you're going to wait.
This is very high risk. So, but with Kickstarter and Indiegogo and these things, you can say, I'm going to write this book, you know, if I get like £7,000 worth of orders, I'll write it. So that's like a really amazing thing to have, which, you know, people that haven't had before, authors. And I'm going to do that model for even speaking. So I'm going to do a talk in London, but it costs about £3,000-£4,000 to hire a venue in London.
Yeah,
you can't do a split like a normal theatre.
So a normal theatre will do a revenue split. Yeah, but a London theatre or a London venue won't.
Like all the proper theatres have got like things on to pay the rent. They have to have like a show on. So you have to like hire like the Royal Geographical Society or some big theatre.
Yeah,
and it costs like £4,000 and. So yeah, you do that, and then there's a tube strike. It's a very high risk thing.
Yeah,
to do.
So you could be taking a massive risk.
Yeah, and a lot of people are like, oh, why don't you speak in London? So it's like, well, like if 300 people buy a ticket for £15, then you know if we get this target in 1 month, then I'll do it. But if we don't, then we won't do it.
So
you get your money back again. So.
So that's the thing. You can use these new platforms, new technology in terms of crowdfunding, and see if the crowd want to and are willing to pay up front for a book or to come to hear you speak in London, and then do it. And of course, I suppose, and we've talked about this on this program quite a bit in the past, but bands that aren't particularly trendy. But have a big following are doing that as well, in terms of crowdfunding their album and then making the album.
Yeah.
So, and it, you know, it's testing your audience appetite for coming in and paying to hear you speak. So
it's ideally as the artist, whether you're a writer or speaker, you need to make the most amount of money possible, because the amount of money there is not that much compared to like something else, another, you know. So the more money you can make as a writer, the more you can write. But like writing books, you don't really make any. The money is minimal, you know. So if a book costs £4.99, I only get like 13% probably of the trade price, you know, in some markets. So you're making 10-15p or something, and a book could sell 30-40,000 copies, which is like really successful in that market of climbing books. But it's not even going to pay, you know, you can't live on that. You need to have about 10 successful books in print, or one or two books which sell, you know, like hundreds and hundreds of thousands of copies, to even have like a basic, you know, basic like standard of living, really.
So listeners, buy Andy's book so he can buy more train tickets. But yeah, it's a really interesting point that because people look at the numbers and think, wow, you must be really, really successful. But actually, with particularly with traditional publishing, you're looking at a book that's on sale for $4.99 at $7.99, and you've got all the different parts of the supply chain from the bookseller through to the publisher. Before you're getting
it. It's not like the author's been ripped off.
No.
Because I have like produced books of people right from the beginning, so I know how it all works. I know that, you know, basically the retailer's getting a third, you know, and then it's been sold for like, so it's been sold for like 2/3 of the cover price, probably. And out of that, you've got to pay for the print, and that's probably going to take a third. And then you've got all the designer and the distribution, and so you've got the distribution in there as well. So it breaks down. So you can see why no one is making any money. And people often say, "Oh, yeah, I saw your digital book, and it was the same price as the real book. Like, that's too expensive." I'm like, "No, it's just that the real book is too cheap."
Yeah,
like a book, really, the real price of a book should be £30-40. So when I did. It's me, myself, and iBook. It's £30.
Yes.
And people are like, oh, that's a lot of money. So, well, you might go to Starbucks with your mates. You might easily buy some sandwiches and spend £30. But this book is going to take me months and months to write.
Yes.
I'm going to draw all the pictures in it, and I'm going to. It's based on 20 years of experience. The value of that to you. And if you were a web designer or you were anything else in any other career, and something you really loved, like a triathlete. Wouldn't even think for a second about spending £30 on some bit from the Brownlee brothers about how to tie your shoelaces. But in climbing, people are like, oh, that's too expensive. So, but then people have to buy it. That's the other thing.
No one's got a gun to their head saying buy this.
Yeah.
And that's it. It's what value people perceive it to be and people put on it as well. And
don't sell yourself too cheaply, really.
But clearly, people are buying the new book, which is me, myself, and I. You've got to go back and sign and post out several hundred.
Well, that's the only problem with Kickstarter is that I am like about a year late. Because you get the money up front, and then all sorts of things like get in the way of. And it's just when you're doing it all yourself, like that's one thing for anybody who's like running a business, like starting a business. The more you can do yourself, the better. You know, you can just save so much money and make more profit if you can do your own website and do your own print and all these things.
And clearly, from what you said earlier, you took the time and the effort to teach yourself to learn about website design, about I suppose optimizing your books for Kindle and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
So you took that decision. It was far better for you and your business in terms of profit to do that yourself.
Also, I didn't have the money
to
pay for it. So I have a website that maybe would cost me like £15,000 if I'd actually paid someone to do it. But I did it myself over like 15 years. I've just slowly been changing it or doing new versions of it. And every time I did a new version, I would learn something new about how to do it. But at the same time, you're learning how to Photoshop, or you're trying to learn how to edit a video together. So you have all these like broad, like I had a business that was like a speaking business, and it was successful at the beginning because I was doing everything. You know, I had a partner, and we worked really well because we tried to do everything ourselves, and we had enough skills to just pull it off to a level where it was okay. But it's when you move up to the next level, when you start paying professionals to do all those things, suddenly the profit just all evaporates.
So you've got to if you do that, you've got to scale sufficiently.
Yeah. It's like a farmer's market. You know, you grow it or you feed it, and then you take it to the market and you sell it and you get the money. And once you start being in a distribution chain of Tesco's or somewhere else, suddenly you're it doesn't work anymore. So I think like a lot of people are probably scared about doing things outside, you know, like to just go out and say, right, buy some software and learn how to do it. But usually it's much easier to do the basics of anything to make it okay. And a lot of it's copying, like looking at other people's websites. I think the first website I ever did, I just literally copied the code from someone's website and stuck it on my server, and then worked out just like almost like dismantling it, like working out what is an image, how does that appear?
Yeah, and take it apart and see how it works. Yeah. I suppose then if you ever go down the route of paying someone to do it for you, it means that you are a very exacting client who knows how things work as well.
Yeah, how to do it, But so they said that about, I was watching a documentary about when they were making fighter planes in the Cold War, and all the people in the management structure understood exactly what was going on. It wasn't like they were paying someone to design a new jet fighter or something. So everyone really understood the role engineers. So it meant that the process was much easier. So if I came and said, I want you to design me a new website, and I want it to do, I want it to be work on a mobile phone and work on all these kind of stuff. So it is, I guess it's being like a, what do you call it, when you're a polymath, you have to have a very broad understanding of like a lot of things. So if it's for a business, my website has to work on a mobile phone because, a huge percentage of people look on mobile phones, not on a desktop anymore.
Indeed, and you'll now be penalised as well by Google, won't you, if your website isn't...
So it's like a little tiny detail that someone who's got like some rubbish flash site from like 10 years ago probably doesn't even realise.
No.
But like everybody else who's like savvy and goes there, oh, that's rubbish, like what kind of business is that? The website, I can't even see it or something. So
you could call it a polymath, or you could call it, the Renaissance person in business.
I guess so, yeah. But you can ignore it. Like I've done quite a lot of work with people who are running businesses which were very successful in the past and are slowly dying on their feet because they're not, they ignore that, like they live in the modern way, in the new century.
So that's really interesting. So you're helping them out in terms of being more responsive, being more flexible, being more adaptive.
We're called like AA something, so we're at the top of the yellow pages. It's like, well, who the hell ever looks at the yellow pages?
Indeed, quite.
So it's that thing that you always get in, you throw it in the bin straight away, or it goes really mouldy outside your front door. So people often just like, oh, I can't be doing anything with all that face, MySpace. I've got a MySpace page. It's trying to get people to, like, you can't ignore all that kind of stuff. It's very stupid even saying it because it's so obvious.
Yeah.
But for some people, it's not obvious.
For some people, it isn't, indeed.
On the website, we want to redo our website. If someone did it, 10 years ago and, like, on some front page or something. And, it's very, really, very. You can, with a bit of knowledge, you can give yourself like hundreds of thousands of pounds worth of value to your business just by understanding the basics of, like, even Squarespace. You can produce a really good quality website just by moving things around. I don't know why businesses don't just do that, because it doesn't cost. It would take you like an evening to do it, but. So
where are you looking for your learning these days then? You're clearly got the appetite for continuing your knowledge development, your learning about everything that you need to know to develop your business as a speaker, as an author. What do you find most useful in terms of sources of advice, sources of help, reading?
I don't have any professional, someone says I'm going to go on a course and learn to do that. I've never been like that in my whole life. I've always been, I'll go to the library or I'll go...
You'll figure it out yourself.
Yeah, I'll go on the internet or I'll buy a book or something. And a lot of it is copy. Like, because I'm very dyslexic, I think I have a very good skill of dismantling something. Like the Russians in the Second World War, an American bomber forced landed in Russia, and they completely dismantled it down to nuts and bolts and rebuilt, a whole fleet of these planes. Yeah. And I always think about that. Like, when you look at something, why does that book look, or why does that, like, all the time you're analysing everything, why does this magazine look better than that one over there? And is it just to do with this line and this, so you're always questioning why something works. Why is Peter Kay really funny? Or why is, why does Steve Coogan, why do I find him funny? Because he doesn't seem that sophisticated, but I find it really, really funny. So you're always like questioning all these things and then breaking it down and then trying to learn something from it. But no formal, like I would never advise anyone to go to university or anything. I would just say, learn, if you've got a passion for it, then just keep at it. But if you haven't, then don't even bother going, trying to, you know, no one's going to give you passion by going to university.
No, you've got to have that passion yourself.
Yeah.
Great. Well, you listen to Business Live, Sheffield Live. We're talking with Andy Kirkpatrick, speaker, climber, author, storyteller. In fact, you talked about describing yourself as a storyteller when you have to tell US Customs what you do. But people who want to hear more, they can watch you on Vimeo or on YouTube, of course. They can go to your website, which is andy-kirkpatrick.com. Yeah. And they can go to one of your forthcoming events as well, as well as buy one of your books. So let's see, event coming up in Sheffield. This is Sheffield Live, but event coming up in Sheffield in February 2016, is that right?
Probably.
Yeah. And all the dates are on the website as well. Good way of seeing what you're up to is Twitter as well.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's Psychovertical.
Yeah, at Psychovertical. Yeah, so I do a bit of a Twittering person.
Yeah, brilliant. Okay, and so the Cold Mountain UK tour is the name of the tour in the UK. Great stuff. So you've built your platform. Any other tips for people about writing, blogging, speaking? Clearly, honesty, authenticity. And I mean that in terms of, probably don't even make yourself do it if you don't want to do it. But if you want to do it, then don't be scared. If you want to do it and you like telling a story, just go and do it.
Yeah, I guess, don't like worry a lot, but also don't worry too much.
You know, the balance right.
Yeah, like try and feel like you can stand by what you do, the work you do. In the future, like don't think, oh, I'm going to come back and go, oh God, what was I doing? That was terrible, you know. So, yeah.
Excellent. Well, Andy Kirkpatrick, thanks very much for joining me today. We're going to play a track of music, which is a track that you've chosen, which is The Astronauts. Everything's a System. Do you want to talk about why you've chosen it?
I guess when I was in America this year, it kept I don't have many songs on my phone, so it kept appearing all the time. So it was, it's kind of got some good memories.
Super. Andy, thank you.
Thank you very much.
That was part of Everything's a System, Everything's a Sign by The Astronauts. Track of music chosen by today's guest, Andy Kirkpatrick, author, speaker, climber. If you've just tuned in and you've missed the interview with Andy, don't panic. You can find the podcast of today's show on the Sheffield Live website, sheffieldlive.org. Next up on Sheffield Live, our fantastic folk music show, Thank Goodness It's Folk. So stay tuned to that. We'll be back next week, Friday morning, 9 a.m. till 10. Thanks for listening.
Inspiration, innovation and insight at MADE, the Entrepreneur Festival. Join us at MADE Festival to be educated and inspired by a jam-packed day of business success. Hear from JB Gill, farmer, entrepreneur and former member of boy band JLS, Annabelle Carmel, cookery author and entrepreneur, Joe McEwen, head of digital at Innocent Drinks and many more. This year we blend inspirational success stories with business skills training, customer service, sales, marketing and social media, all designed to help you win more customers and increase profit. MADE, the Entrepreneur Festival, 22nd of October, Sheffield City Hall. Visit madefestival.com for more information.
Sheffield Live. Made in Sheffield. Made by you.